From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, on the front lines with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, we talk with Boston Globe reporter Charles Sennett. He traveled with the Northern Alliance from late September through mid-October. We'll also talk with Sennett about the escalation in the Middle East conflict. He's the Boston Globe's former Middle East bureau chief and its current bureau chief in London. His new book, The Body and the Blood, is about why the Christian population is dwindling in the Middle East, the place where the faith began. And it examines the predicament of Christian Palestinians as the Palestinian Intifada becomes increasingly Islamist. Charles Sennett, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Authorities say respiratory anthrax probably killed two Washington, D.C. postal workers who died today. Two of their colleagues are hospitalized with the same form of the disease. Dr. Mitch Cohen of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention acknowledged today that officials don't know the source of the anthrax or the intended target.
Farmers Insurance Group had been accused of redlining, excluding customers based on their race or the racial makeup of their neighborhood. Now, in the largest redlining settlement...
It apparently is the wrong tape. We had the Mitch Cohen of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who talked today about not knowing the source of the anthrax that has killed, apparently killed, the two Washington, D.C. postal workers. The tests are still out and have not been confirmed. Federal Superfund money will be used to pay for the cleanup of a Boca Raton, Florida office building contaminated with anthrax. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
An official at the Environmental Protection Agency said about $500,000 from the Superfund Hazardous Waste Cleanup Program has been allocated to clean up the offices of American Media Incorporated. Anthrax spores were found in at least two locations in the building earlier this month after one employee died from the inhalation form of anthrax. The FBI has essentially finished its search of the building, and now the EPA will manage its decontamination. The Environmental Agency will likely test the entire building to make sure the spores did not spread. Then it could use techniques ranging from low-tech bleach solutions to high-tech vaporized hydrogen peroxide to disinfect the building. American Media, however, has already said it will not move back into its former offices. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
India's prime minister has ruled out peace talks with Pakistan for now because he says Pakistan continues to support terrorist groups in Kashmir. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee's tough stand against Pakistan comes as his party is preparing for elections in a key northern state. He has virtually ruled out any chance of talks in New York next month with the President of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, during meetings of the UN General Assembly. Vajpayee said it is pointless to hold peace talks as long as Pakistan supports what he called cross-border terrorism. Meanwhile, four separatist guerrillas were killed in Indian-controlled Kashmir when they attacked a military airport. One Indian soldier and a civilian also died. The Lashkar-e-Taiba, a group based in Pakistan, says its members carried out the strike. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 173 points to 93.77. The Nasdaq was up 37 points. And the S&P 500 rose 16 points. This is NPR News. City officials in New York have postponed today's reopening of One Liberty Plaza. The 53-story skyscraper is located at the southwest corner of the World Trade Center site. The director of the Mayor's Office of Emergency Management says the reopening is being delayed because some areas still need to be cleaned up. He did not say when the buildings would reopen. Raytheon has announced plans to sell 29 million shares of common stock. Alex Ashlock of member station WBUR reports from Boston.
Raytheon makes the Tomahawk cruise missiles and other guided weapons being used to bomb Taliban targets in Afghanistan. And company officials expect more orders from American and British forces as the war against terrorism continues. Some of the weapons made by Raytheon cost as much as $1 million each. Last week, Raytheon announced a $285 million, 79 cents per share loss for the third quarter. The company hopes the stock sale will generate $1 billion to help reduce debt and pay general operating expenses. Raytheon's stock price surged after the September 11th terrorist attacks on the belief that the company will benefit from increased military spending. For NPR News, I'm Alex Ashlock in Boston.
A key gauge of future economic activity posted its biggest decline in nearly 6 years last month. The Conference Board reported today its index of leading economic indicators fell 0.5% last month. The decrease in the monthly index is the largest since January of 1996. The board said the reading reflects a significant slowdown in the manufacturing and service sectors. The index indicates where the overall U.S. economy is headed in the next 3 to 6 months. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Charles Sennett, has been on the front lines with some of the leaders of the Northern Alliance, the Afghan opposition group that the United States is supporting in the fight against the Taliban. Sennett reported from northern Afghanistan from late September through mid-October. He's the London bureau chief for the Boston Globe and was the Globe's Middle East bureau chief from 1997 until earlier this year. He's also the author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of the Century. It examines why the Christian population is disappearing from the Middle East, the place where the faith began. I spoke with Charles Sennett this morning. He was at the NPR Bureau in London. I want to start off by talking about your travels through northern Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance. Let's start with a report that you wrote a couple of weeks ago. You were with Commander Mullah Omar, one of the local leaders of the Northern Alliance, and one of his men brought out a Taliban soldier that they had captured. Would you describe the scene?
Well, when we met with Mullah Omar, who is not to be confused with the one-eyed Mullah Omar, who is the spiritual leader of the Taliban, he actually came out first with green tea and these little candies, caramel-flavored candies, that all of the local commanders seemed to want to feed to Western correspondents like myself who are trying to get to know the Northern Alliance. And we had an interview in which this Mullah Omar talked about the Northern Alliance, talked about the hopes of the commanders there to really capitalize on the pending U.S. airstrikes. And it all seemed like kind of a solid interview with a man who was very serious about his military fortune and what he had hoped lies ahead. Almost out of the blue, he kind of snapped his fingers and asked literally for the prisoner to be summoned. And we didn't really know what was going on. And then the prisoner was brought up from a hole, which was dug in the earth, this kind of brown tundra that's right outside of his military command and home. And it was one of these incredibly barbaric images of Afghanistan that makes you think as a correspondent, do we really know what we're getting into here? The man was given a ladder which was lowered down to him, and he emerged out of the earth. And this was a really small hole, 3 feet by 3 feet, which bottled out a little bit at the bottom. I don't know exactly how much. It's approximately 12 feet deep. And his face was thin and haggard, and he was very clearly in pain. He was very clearly afraid. He was spitting up blood. And for an American journalist who is trying to understand this enemy, the Taliban, it's a fairly jarring image to be introduced to the face of the enemy as this pitiful soul coming up from a hole in the earth.
What was it like for you to witness this? Did you have to act nonplussed, like this was a perfectly average way for people to behave with their prisoners?
No, we actually challenged Mullah Omar a little bit on this. Myself and my translator were both kind of taken aback by the condition of the prisoner, and I was with some other colleagues, and we really pressed him and said, you know, how can you treat this man this way? And he insisted he gives him bread and water and that he'll be fine. And there was just this sense of we didn't understand where we were, and I think that's true. I think that Americans are going to have to get to know the Northern Alliance and realize that the Northern Alliance is maybe Northern, but not so clearly an alliance, and it's a very complicated mix of warlords, commanders, some of whom are very decent, some of whom are, among the perpetrators of some very serious war crimes and some very serious human rights abuses. And I think that for now, the United States is being very careful as it approaches the Northern Alliance to weigh all those factors. So I think my reaction was probably a kind of frontline reaction that America's going to have with the Northern Alliance, and that's asking, who are these guys?
Well, let's ask again, who are these guys? Mullah Omar, and again, this isn't Mullah Omar of the Taliban. This is a local anti-Taliban leader with the same name. You describe him as a Muslim cleric as well as a local warlord. He was once an Islamic scholar. You say that he has a strict interpretation of the Quran that is only marginally more moderate than the Taliban. Is this kind of typical that a lot of the leaders of the Northern Alliance are not quite as extreme, but still fairly extreme in their interpretation of Islam?
They are very extreme in their interpretation of Islam, but also moderate in important areas, I would say. One of them, of course, being in the way in which they interpret Islamic scripture and the social guidelines for women, for example. I don't think in the Northern Alliance-held areas you're going to see women radically shedding the burqa. I don't know that that's going to happen, because many of the commanders and many of the mullahs who run these local towns believe that women should wear the burqa. The difference is they want to give people more choice, basically, give women more choice. But the notion of these strict social codes being imposed is very much still there. Another important difference is most of the Northern Alliance mullahs who I was able to interview believe that girls should be able to be educated. Of course, in the Taliban areas, girls do not go to school past a certain age, and here they're saying they should continue in their education. So those are important differences. But when you get down to their understanding of the Quran and their shaping of society around Sharia or Islamic law, they're very similar in more ways than they are different.
Now, you also met Commander Rashid Dostum of the Northern Alliance. What's his role in the war?
I was able to speak with General Dostum over a satellite phone, which to me was like speaking with Kurtz on a satellite phone. It's this it's this very strange scene in which we were in a garden of some of Dostum's officers who are now actually displaced people from the areas of Mazar Sharif, which were overtaken by the Taliban. They're very eager to get in the fight there and retake Mazar Sharif. And Dostum was on the phone kind of bragging about how close they're coming to accomplishing that. We were in this situation of having to listen to him on my satellite phone on a speakerphone while all of his officers were kind of, you know, glued to this, listening to the translations. And really just hinging on every word that he was speaking as if it was the truth. I didn't frankly believe it. I still think that Dostum is exaggerating how much headway they've made in the Taliban areas. We are in a position as reporters not to be able to confirm these reports. But I also was in a position where I kept trying to ask Dostum about his very complicated past. And I wanted to know specifically about the allegations of some very serious brutality on the part of his soldiers under his command when he was kind of running the show when these forces had control of Kabul and when he had control of Mazar Sharif. He was famous, kind of legendary warlord who had his own bulletproof Cadillac. He had his own airline. He favors scotch. He likes gambling. He's this very complicated character who, as I say, also perpetrated great brutality on the people who differed with him, especially any opposing militias. And he's famous for tying different militia members' limbs to different tanks and sending the tanks in different directions and things like this. So I was very anxious to get in those questions, and he kept saying to me, "It is not time to ask such questions. We are at war. Just take down what I'm saying and tell the American people." And I kept kind of politely trying to interrupt him, and he kept washing over these questions. And it was another one of these images where, as an American reporter in Afghanistan, you feel that you really understand the ways in which the Northern Alliance wants to capitalize on the U.S. airstrikes and the U.S. goals in creating a post-Taliban Afghanistan. But you also begin to see that these are characters who are going to have to be watched very closely. One of the things that I'm worried about as a reporter and seeing in the future is this stirring of the ethnic coals in Afghanistan. The Taliban are ethnic Pashtun. The Northern Alliance are largely ethnic Tajiks and Uzbeks. General Dostum is a famous leader of the Uzbeks. Now, if they return to Mazar-e-Sharif, if General Dostum and his forces return to Mazar-e-Sharif, they are going to want to exact revenge on the Pashtuns who are still there. And I think that what we have to do is really, as a country, be careful with this mix and not allow those ethnic rivalries and hatreds to become rekindled and to fan the flame again. And that's going to take some sophistication, and it's going to take keeping a close eye on people like General Dostum.
Well, you write in your article about Dostum that his excesses are part of the reason why the Taliban were at first welcomed when they took Kabul in 1996.
Exactly. I mean, the Taliban appeared at that point, at least, like a kind of enlightened alternative to the brutality of the warlords who had taken Kabul and who were holding on to power quite ruthlessly. I think we've learned subsequently, and I think the Afghan people, more importantly, have learned that the Taliban were anything but enlightened and actually dragged the country back deep into kind of a medieval philosophy of Islam and a kind of medieval economy, frankly, that seems almost pre-industrial when you're there. It's just astounding to go through this country, at least the parts we were able to go through, and see the way people are living, to see this poverty, to see the complete destruction of their infrastructure, and, again, a sense that you're living in about the 14th century.
My guest is Charles Sennett, the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East bureau chief. From late September through mid-October, he traveled with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe. He's the Globe's London bureau chief, the former Middle East bureau chief, and the author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. Did you get to interview many women in Afghanistan?
I was able to interview really only one woman face-to-face. And after about a month of traveling through Northern Afghanistan and being in the company of all men and mostly military men and staying in the barracks with the Northern Alliance and being out on the front line, literally in the trenches with different commanders and tank battalions and crossing the river with these workhorses that were led by these traders who know the trails and lead you on the horses, you realize you haven't seen a woman for a long time. And the world is not a good place without women. And it's a very bleak landscape in which women are, of course, completely covered in the burqa. Very rarely do you see a woman at the market. But I met one woman, and that was a meeting that was arranged because I had heard that there was a woman who was trying her best to run a local organization called the Afghanistan Women's Association in the town of Khojabuddin, which has become what I call Media Stan. This is where all of the TV camera crews are camped out, and there are satellite dishes, and CBS News is buying up an entire house for their staff, and the BBC has this kind of well-groomed colonial atmosphere in their house, and it's an absolute city of modern Western journalists living in this kind of pre-industrial marketplace where they've radically altered the currency, where they've completely shattered the local social codes, and it's created lots of problems. And in this strange modern mix in Afghanistan, there is a woman, Madame Nazir, who is emerged as the woman who the media can speak to. and she runs the Afghanistan Women's Association. She is part of a kind of Kabul elite who left Kabul when it fell to the Taliban, lived in Pakistan. She's married to a very educated man, a nice man, an engineer. And this couple work with Médecins Sans Frontières doing nutrition projects, and they also have classes, which Madame Nazir runs, for women to understand the human rights as they pertain to women and as they are encoded in the Quran and in Islamic law. What I found out was this woman, who was so eloquent and just wonderful to speak with, has been pretty much silenced by some of the local commanders of the Northern Alliance. The specific commander who has been tough on her work is a man named Qazi Kabir, another commander who loved to give tea and hand out candies to Western journalists like myself. And I had learned that Qazi Kabir had actually killed his wife, his first wife, with an AK-47 for daring to ask him where he was going when he was returning to battle 20 years ago. And this was kind of the legend in town. And so when I met with Qazi Kabir, I asked him about this. And he told me, no, no, no. These are enemies. They have the story completely wrong. Yes, I killed my wife with an AK-47, but she wasn't asking me where I was going. She was pulling my rifle because I was trying to clean it. And then I accidentally pulled on the trigger and she was killed. So this local commander has this story, and the town has an understanding of who the local commander is. And somewhere in there must be the truth, but the sense of this commander kind of blanketing his sense of Islam around this town of Hoja Baldin is very evident.
You were on the front lines in Afghanistan for a while. And, you know, I've just been sitting in my office and sitting home watching some news footage. And you see soldiers from the Northern Alliance on horseback looking like it could have been centuries ago. And at the same time, you know that there's a lot of ultra-modern U.S. weaponry being used in this battle. So it seems like there's several centuries at a time that are represented in the front lines and in the war in general.
That's a very good way to put it. When you go out there on horseback, and I am not the greatest horseback rider, you know, I'm kind of holding on to this saddle made of burlap and stuffed with straw, and this frayed rope that you're holding on to as you forge the Kaukcha River. It's very much a Hemingway fantasy, and you're very much in a World War I setting of artillery fire. And you also realize, as a reporter, you aren't even anywhere close to the story. Yes, you're on a front line. Yes, you are hearing lots of artillery fire thudding into the hills around you. You're in a trench. You hear tanks, you know, kind of... You can hear the tanks as they rocket off into the distance with the latest round of sustained shelling that you will certainly write about. But what you're seeing has nothing to do with the U.S. offensive on Afghanistan. It has to do with this 20-some-odd-year continuum of fighting that's gone on within Afghanistan. So I think the fronts that we've covered and the reports that we broadcast or wrote for our newspapers actually existed in some time warp. And as I say, it's like being stuck inside of World War I while you cover the first war of the 21st century. The front you're covering has very little to do with America's war against the Taliban or against Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization. Those fronts are going to be in places like banks and understanding money laundering and how that works and how these agencies are funded. Those are going to be in things like understanding how you track anthrax spores. And I think those are going to be the really shadowy front lines of this war that will be very complex, that will be very difficult to follow, that will require skill sets that reporters are only just now beginning to develop. And those of us who end up on the front lines covering artillery fire have some old sense of war, some old-fashioned notions of the front line and what this conflict is really all about.
You've written pretty critically about the Northern Alliance, but when you were traveling with them and when you were on the front lines in northern Afghanistan, you were dependent on the Northern Alliance for your safety. Did they have any idea of what you were writing and how critical you were?
I don't know yet. I think the answer, I guess, lies in Afghanistan. There are so many shifting alliances. Some of the commanders I'm meeting with were arch rivals of the commander I would meet later that afternoon. And in this mix of rivalries and of old vendettas, I don't know that my coverage will necessarily jump out at them as particularly critical. I think I was actually somewhat behind on that criticism. I think some of my first few days of reporting in there, I was really buying into the excitement of the Northern Alliance, feeling like it's going to push ahead, that it's going to really seize the moment with the U.S. airstrikes and accomplish the, quote, liberation of Mazar Sharif or the liberation of Kabul. But I think, really, I had an education about the Northern Alliance that's probably not dissimilar to the one that America is going to have over the coming weeks and months, in which we're going to learn more about the General Dostums, in which we're going to learn more about these local commanders, even like Mullah Omar with his prisoner. And we're all going to see that this is a very complex place, that the Northern Alliance may be Northern, but it's not necessarily an alliance. It's certainly not the armed wing of Amnesty International. These guys have serious human rights abuses in their past. And I think all of that is going to be part of our realization that Afghanistan is an infinitely complex place with a long history of becoming a graveyard for empires, and that we are going to have to proceed very carefully and very cautiously.
Charles Sennett is the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East bureau chief. His new book is called The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Charles Sennett talks about the Middle East. He's the Boston Globe's former Middle East bureau chief and is the author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, about the dwindling Christian population in the Middle East. We'll hear about the predicament of Christian Palestinians as the Intifada becomes increasingly Islamist. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Charles Sennett. He's the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and served as its Middle East bureau chief from 1997 until earlier this year. His new book, The Body and the Blood, examines why the Christian population is dwindling in the Middle East, the place where the faith began. Christians now comprise only 2% of the population in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, whereas 100 years ago, the Christian population in that same region was 20%. I asked Sennett how he thinks the Middle East conflict is going to affect or be affected by the war against terrorism.
I think in Israel you'll see a sense of camaraderie almost, or a kind of embrace, a sympathetic embrace with the United States. There's this sense that misery loves company almost, this sense of, you know, we've gone through this, we know now you're going through it, we want to stand by you, and we want you to realize what we've been through for so long, so welcome aboard. I think for the Palestinians, it's really a sense of feeling cornered, that the forces within the very conservative government of Ariel Sharon are going to try to cast Yasser Arafat and all of the Palestinian leadership as part of a continuum of terrorism, to resurrect the images of Arafat as a terrorist, as he used to appear in the 1970s on the covers of Time and Newsweek, and try to bring him back to being that person, and thereby limit his ability to negotiate the future of a Palestinian state. And I think Arafat's aware of that, and I think he realizes that there is an extreme burden on him right now to come up with arrests of the cabinet minister who was assassinated in Jerusalem.
The arrests of the terrorists who killed the cabinet minister.
Specifically to come after these people who killed this minister, who are within the PFLP, who are a very militant wing of the PFLP. And Arafat needs to control them, and Arafat needs to produce some arrests, and Arafat needs to show the world that he is indeed also part of the war on terrorism. And I think that will be a big challenge ahead for Arafat, because it will mean he'll have to turn against some of his own people. I think we're going to see Arafat in extreme pressure on the Palestinian streets. And I think Arafat is clearly aware of that, and I think he's worried about it. So all of these different vying agendas will all come into play. But I still think for Osama bin Laden, the real inspiration for his movement is not Palestine. It's not the dream of a Palestinian state. It's not human rights for Palestinians. He's shown remarkable disregard for the Palestinians. I think for him, it really is the presence of U.S. troops in the Gulf, and specifically in Saudi Arabia.
So you think he's just using the Palestinian cause to make his cause more popular, to make him more popular?
I really do. I think that is also the sense of the Palestinian street. Yes, you can see some posters of Osama bin Laden in certain very militant pockets of Gaza. But the truth is, Palestinians are very sophisticated. They understand that the Arab world in general, and Osama bin Laden in particular, have not done much for the Palestinian cause. There's a lot of lip service, but there's not a lot of delivery. There's not a lot of support. There's not a lot of making this issue in the forefront and the, you know, kind of on the global agenda. So I think he has used it, and I think he's using it even more desperately now as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict heats up. But I still think what Osama bin Laden cares about is U.S. troop presence in the Gulf, and specifically in Saudi Arabia and what he would define as the Holy Land of Mecca and Medina, and the notion that these U.S. troops have somehow defiled that Holy Land.
Do you have a reading on what the Bush administration thinks is in America's best interest now regarding Israel and the Palestinians?
The Bush administration is going to have to really very clearly put its weight behind bringing both the Israelis and the Palestinians to a negotiating table. The way I think they're going to have to do that is to be tougher on Arafat about really pushing forward on going after terrorists. They've done that consistently all along. They're going to keep that pressure up, and they're going to let him know how important that is. But they're also going to have to do something that they've been more hesitant to do and that really needs to be done, which is to tell Israel that it needs to live up to the agreements that were signed after Oslo. And there's 8 years of agreements that have gone violated by both sides, by both Palestinians and by Israelis. But the expansion of settlements, the notion of the policy of assassination, which Israel has used, and all of these real thorny issues that the United States has not been clear enough in speaking against in relation with its ally Israel, it's going to have to do that now. When it does that is a different question. I think it's not going to do it in the immediate term because it doesn't want to appear to be somehow trying to placate the Arab world as a result of what bin Laden did in New York and in Washington. But I do think down the line, we're going to have to expect more from our ally Israel in the Middle East.
In your new book, The Body and the Blood, you write about the disappearance of Christians from the Middle East. And you retrace the steps, the journey of Jesus, and look for the Christian population there now. In writing about Christians in the Middle East, you also write about the contemporary conflict in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians. And you write about the Intifada, the first Intifada and the new Intifada that's a year old. What are some of the ways in which you see this new Intifada as being different from the first one?
The new Intifada is really not even an Intifada, because if you understand the term, it really means kind of a shrugging off, a collective shaking off of oppression. I think this is very different. I think this is a very specific guerrilla street fight among certain aspects, some of whom have very different agendas, in trying to confront Israel along the borders of what is a weakly defined Palestinian state at this point, in which they want to define very clearly as their Palestinian state. Some up to the 1967 borders, and some, frankly, who see it as beyond the 1967 borders. And I think the notion of an intifada as a popular uprising against Israel is not what's happening here. This is an armed conflict against Israel. It's completely changed the way in which the intifada unfolds on the street. At the beginning of this intifada, we were seeing the same images we all know of burning tires, rock throwing, Israeli troops marching forward, Israeli troops firing tear gas, then rubber bullets, then live ammunition, young children, 13, 15-year-old, being killed, and very much a sense of, well, here we go again, here's another intifada. But very quickly it became Palestinian gunmen firing from different points set back from these traditional intifada conflicts. And then suddenly we were hearing tank fire or, you know, helicopter missiles being fired in from the Israelis. And now the equation began to unravel. It wasn't an intifada. It was really becoming something just short of war. I think what we're seeing now, even today in the West Bank, with the new Israeli incursion into Bethlehem, is really becoming even more and more like a conventional war, in which we're seeing the tanks really begin to enter these areas, and we're seeing the fighting on the street with the Fatah gunmen out there kind of crouched down on corners and trying to really present some resistance to the tanks. So I think it's been a process of recognizing over a period of weeks, months, and now even more than a year, that this is not an intifada, that this is a real conflict that is looming and that threatens to become a regional conflict if it's not contained and if it's not brought under control fairly quickly.
Now, I think it's also fair to say that you see the new intifada or the new fighting as being more Islamist-inspired than the first intifada was. The agenda of the groups at the forefront of this fighting are much more Islamist.
That's true, and I think the language on the street is much more Islamist. In trying to really pursue the path of Jesus' life in the year 2000, what I was trying to look at was the way in which the themes that were relevant 2,000 years ago are relevant today. 2,000 years ago, they were still talking about globalization. They were talking about occupation. They were talking about religious extremism, and they were talking about the quest to control Jerusalem. And now we see all of this at play again across the Holy Land on these very same sites. You know, this whole intifada was started, of course, where the Temple Mount once lay and where today there is the Dome of the Rock. So I think the sense of the origins of this and its connections to the Bible really jumped out at me. What makes this reality interesting to me is that it's increasingly being seen along these religious lines, and that those issues that are more economic or that are more secular, like occupation, like globalization, they're being pushed down to the surface, while these issues that are more religious are being more clearly brought to the surface and used to shape this conflict. One of the clearest examples of this is today, the Palestinians call this the Al-Aqsa Intifada. And Al-Aqsa refers to the Dome of the Rock, to the mosque that lays there within the compound that's known as the Noble Sanctuary. So I think when you hear Al-Aqsa Intifada, that immediately defines it as a battle for this holy space. And what interests me in pursuing this with the Christians was to notice that this completely cuts out the Christian Palestinians, and it completely removes their very important role in Palestinian society and in the Palestinian cause, and it marginalizes it. And I think secular Muslims are keenly aware of this, and Christian Palestinians are also keenly aware of the dangers of having this conflict be defined as a religious one.
My guest is Charles Sennett. He's the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and its former Middle East bureau chief. His new book is called The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Sennett, the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East bureau chief. His new book is called The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. Well, you have a particularly interesting chapter on Hanan Ashrawi in your new book. And Hanan Ashrawi is one of the leading Palestinian negotiators, and she has been one of the leading media spokespeople for the Palestinian cause. She's Christian. She's a Christian Palestinian. And, reading your chapter on her, I kept wondering, what's it like for her as a Christian to be part of this movement that is growing increasingly Islamist, knowing that this extreme Islamist movement has very little room for women? I mean, much of the Islamist extreme wants women in the house, wearing a burqa on those rare occasions when they're outside of the house. So what was her reaction to that?
Well, Hanan has always been a very eloquent and passionate spokesperson for the Palestinian cause. And I think Americans really know the Palestinian cause through Hanan Ashrawi, or possibly through Edward Said, which, interestingly, both of whom are Christian. So in a way, America and the West have been presented the Palestinian cause is very much a Palestinian Christian interpretation of that cause, as a fight for independence, as a fight against occupation. And they haven't understood that on the street, with Hamas, with Islamic Jihad, with many of the more traditional aspects of Palestinian Islamic culture, it's a very different battle. And I think what you see when you talk with Hanan Ashrawi now is this disconnect, this sense that what she was longing for when she became prominent in 1987 on the show Nightline and began to really emerge as a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause was a very secular, a very Western concept of human rights, of civil rights, of wanting to create an independent state, a kind of post-colonial atmosphere in which they wanted their rights too. And what she's caught up in now is a completely different vortex, and she was very honest with me about how it depresses her, that this has become very much a battle defined along religious lines. She would be the first to say these issues aren't about religion. They're about land, they're about international law, they're about human rights. But she can see this conflict defining itself increasingly along religious lines. And for people who are secular, whether they're Muslim or Christian, and especially for Palestinian Christians, who are this very diminishing minority, This is very troubling because it has marginalized them. And I think it's marginalized a part of the Palestinian society that has made an extraordinary contribution to its gains.
Although Hanan Ashrawi talked with you about these concerns, my impression was that she's actually pretty reluctant to discuss them in public.
Hanan Ashrawi is an excellent spokesperson for the cause. So Hanan Ashrawi has been very careful in the few minutes she gets of airtime to stick to the main issues. I think if Hanan Ashrawi were to have a forum in which she could go deeper into these issues and to point out the ways in which Israel has also made this much more of a religious conflict, the ways in which Israel has increasingly defined its Zionism as religious, and the way in which Israel faces a real conflict with its own fundamentalists within its country pushing for an agenda to define the Jewish state a certain way. And if she could then counterpose that to the emergence of Islamic fundamentalism within her society and the ways in which that's recast the debate, then she would present it to you fairly. But in any forum where she feels it's just going to be looked at as a Christian complaining about the Muslims, she's very skeptical, she's very wary of the attempts to divide and rule, and I understand that wariness, and I think it's fair enough given the history of the West's attempts to do precisely that.
If the Islamist groups become the leaders of a new Palestinian state, what kind of room will there be for Palestinian Christians within that state?
This is one of the real troubling questions for Palestinian Christians now. They are seeing their numbers leave in another historic exodus. This immigration pattern began a long time ago. It's complex, it's multi-layered, it has to do with education, it has to do with economy. But they've been leaving the Holy Land for a very long time, and their immigration is accelerating right now amid this new conflict in a way that hasn't been seen really since 1948. They're very worried, frankly, that they won't even exist to play a role. There are people like Bernard Sabella at Bethlehem University, a demographer who is predicting that in two generations, the Christian presence in the land where Christianity began will no longer be a demographic reality. In other words, it'll be less than a fraction of a percent, and therefore they won't be able to include it in the demographic studies of the land. So this sense of perilousness, just in terms of numbers, is preeminent.
Where does Arafat fit into the Islamist emphasis on the Palestinian uprising of today? Is he seen as being, as sharing that agenda, or as being too secular?
He's seen as effectively exploiting that on the one hand, but also for those within Palestinian society, they know he is really a secular leader who is greatly challenged by Hamas and by Islamic Jihad, who represent this force of Islam coming deeply in a fundamentalist way into Palestinian society. So I think Arafat exists on many different levels. He exists in the way he presents himself to the Western world. He exists in the way in which he presents himself within Palestinian community and society. And he exists in the way he presents himself to the Arab world. He's kind of played all three of these identities at different times, both using kind of the notion of an Islamic battle for the Holy Land, for, you know, the Dome of the Rock, and all Muslims must come together to defend that. And on the other hand, he'll shift and tell Western analysts, we must be very careful of these Islamic fundamentalists in our midst. So once again, Arafat emerges as this very astute man on the international stage who's managed to always redefine himself and to always redefine his movement. His relationship specifically to the Christians is an interesting one because he's surrounded by Christian advisors and has been very careful in coddling, frankly, the Christian community, knowing that the images of Bethlehem, for example, under attack by the Israelis, is a very resonant image in the West. And that's a very sophisticated little front of that war going on there, in which the Israelis are very sensitive to it, and Arafat is very aware of the ways in which it can be exploited and dramatically illustrate just what's going on in this conflict.
My guest is Charles Sennett. He's the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and its former Middle East bureau chief. His new book is called The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Charles Sennett. He writes for the Boston Globe. He's the Globe's London bureau chief. He just got back from northern Afghanistan. He's the former Middle East correspondent and the author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. In today's papers, it's reported that yesterday Israeli military killed a Christian Palestinian youth in Bethlehem, and that's one of the towns that Israel has invaded. Do you think the killing of a Christian Palestinian youth was reported any differently than the killing of a Muslim Palestinian youth?
Yes, I think that when you're dealing with the Christian presence in the Holy Land and you're dealing with a place as resonant to Christianity as Bethlehem and the whole idea of nativity, I think Americans and I think the Western world stop for a minute and they think, well, wait a minute, you mean there are Palestinian Christians? I don't think the world at large is really even aware of the fact that Palestinian Christians exist and that there is this slim minority of Christians who would define themselves as Palestinian who live with their Muslim brothers. And I think in a short-circuit way of thinking, most Americans say Palestinian equals Muslim, Muslim equals Palestinian, Arab equals Muslim equals Palestinian, and they just do this math all the time. So I think, yes, it does get covered differently because it resonates differently. To understand the diminishing presence of the Christian population within the Palestinian society and within the state of Israel, where Palestinians live as Israeli citizens, then you can begin to tease out so many different issues, and you can look at the Christians as a kind of litmus test or canaries in a coal mine who can really gauge the human rights abuses, the ways in which their democracies are succeeding or failing, not only for the Israelis, but also for the new and emerging Palestinian leadership. So I do think it gets covered differently. And I think specifically when this Christian youth was killed, the reporters seem to stress this notion that a Christian youth was killed in a crossfire because it would have to be a Christian youth killed in a crossfire, right? Because a Christian couldn't be involved in the war against the Jewish state from a Muslim-Palestinian side. So they kind of stress that to allow people to make sense of it all. But the truth is, from knowing this, from being on the streets of the West Bank and being on the streets of Bethlehem and seeing that fighting firsthand, there are many Muslim kids who are killed in the crossfire who have nothing to do with these two sides. But maybe we're not so careful to point that out as we are when it is a Christian Palestinian.
You write that when you left the Middle East, you were relieved in a way because you didn't want your children growing up surrounded by so much hate. And so now you're London bureau chief. You're from the United States. And here we are. There are many, many Islamists who hate the United States, who hate England too, hate everything that the West stands for. Do you feel now like you can't really remove your children from that environment of hate?
I think we all feel that. I mean, I think one of the new realities after September 11th is this feeling that we all have to look over our shoulders. When we were living in Jerusalem, it was very hard, for example, to get family members to come see us because they had these notions of buses blowing up and they had notions of bombs exploding near the old city. And of course they were. But they weren't the only reality of Jerusalem. They were one reality and one that is written about extensively. But we always tried to convince people, come see us. And people would kind of shake their heads and say, no thanks, we'll see you next summer. And when we left Jerusalem, as the new Intifada began to really intensify and as the bombings began to happen more and more frequently and they began to intersect more and more with the paths that we crossed in our lives, going to school or going to the shopping mall, we felt so relieved to get out of there, to feel like we had this weight lifted from our shoulders, that we finally didn't have to kind of watch very carefully while we sipped coffee in the morning some man coming through town who looks like he might be from Gaza. We felt finally like we could relax. And that was September 1st when we got to London. And as of September 11th, I think the whole world feels like Jerusalem. The whole world suddenly feels like a place where you have to sip your coffee very carefully and watch who's walking around you. And I think that's one of the real tragedies of what happened, is that it's going to push us to move to the right of ourselves or something, or to move to a side of ourselves that's going to define the world increasingly along, well, this is Islam, this is Christianity, this is the West, that's the East. And I think that's going to be a real mistake if we allow that to happen. I think that September 11th shook America and shook the world. And it happened in a void in which America doesn't understand the Middle East, and it doesn't understand some pretty legitimate yearnings within the Middle East. And I think that if we can not react with fear, but maybe try to react with a greater understanding, to try to really understand the issues that shape the hatred in the modern Middle East, I think then we're going to be able to see just how marginalized bin Laden is, just how small an enemy he really is. Because he isn't about all those great yearnings in the Middle East. He is about a very narrow fringe that has accomplished an extraordinary act of terrorism, but one that is completely disproportionate with who the man is and what the goals of his organization represent.
Well, Charles Sennett, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Charles Sennett is the author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of a New Millennium. He's the Boston Globe's London Bureau Chief and former Middle East Bureau Chief. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hall, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Living Terrors, What America Needs to Know to Survive the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe by Dr. Michael Osterholm and John Schwartz. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Photographer Joel Meyerowitz used to take pictures of the World Trade Center from his studio window. Now he's at Ground Zero every day, documenting the aftermath of the attacks and the cleanup. We'll talk about his photos and life at Ground Zero on the next Fresh Air.